Health Talks with Dr. Trin. The one show, maybe the only show, that helps you sift through the noise and learn how to make your life a healthier one, starting today with the man who always starts the day off with some healthy routines here, Dr. Trin himself. Welcome, sir.
Hey, good morning. My healthy routine, just sitting on my couch right now.
Is that it?
No, good enough. Good enough.
Staying safe. Well, you got somebody who doesn't just sit on his couch. He goes out in the community and helps people every single day. It sounds like he does these wound walks. Tell me about your guest here. This is amazing.
Yes, yes. This is my hero, Michael Wright, who I've been on one of his daily service, his daily ministry, I call it, where we had met up with folks on the street, folks who are the least of these on the street, those who are homeless. And he literally carries along one of those, what do you call those things that you pull, like wagon?
We have four now. We have four wagons.
Four wagons loaded with food, medical supplies, lots of medical supplies, and all the different stuff that you do. And he just goes out there and serves the homeless community in Orange County.
Most of us are running from the homeless, and he's running towards them to help with a hand out here. Hand
yes,
open.
He does. Welcome, Michael.
Well, thank you, Doctor. Thank you for having us this morning during these unique times that we are surrounded with pain, but more importantly, we are supported by love.
Wow. Listen to that. Well, tell us what made you do this crazy thing. Why would you go? You were what, an EMT, an emergency person here? I don't know what that's called, emergency personnel?
Sure. EMT, emergency medical technician. That was, you know, decades ago growing up in the Midwest. We tend to volunteer for things. And so, you know, bringing forth that community, I moved from Dana Point to Santa Ana, and outside our doors were human beings on the ground. And we that should be shocking all the time to us. And that at that moment, I had a little first aid bag and a baby bottle with wound wash in it, and then creating the relationships where people would be more comfortable. And as the doc will attest to, that when a patient presents themselves for treatment, sometimes it's not the thing that it's really that's affecting their quality of life and their health. They may have a pain here in the arm that they would like to have go away right away, but there may be some other things too that are going on that need to be addressed. And those can be complex skin infections. Those are respiratory issues. And Doc, when you were out with us, one of the first and the best things that we can do for people is get flowing water over people's skin. Mm. So the lack of hygiene that's available during a pandemic, individuals who would rely on jack-in-the-box or libraries to be able to go in and just wash their hands, those are closed. So imagine what happens to your skin when you don't have flowing water on you and no change of clothes.
You're blowing my mind here. I can't imagine the simplest of things that we take for granted. Having water flow over your body in some fashion, running water on your hands, running water on your body, running water on your wounds. This is something that is unavailable to a large number of people in our affluent Orange County. Unbelievable.
So Doc, when you were helping us wash people, and you saw the condition of their skin, how would you describe that? And with your experience, what do we call that? What happens, what actually happens with the skin when we block the pores, we trap bacteria inside, and then we start to develop antibiotic resistance infections? What's going on there?
When you're out and about as someone without a home, right, or a homeless person, and you lack that hygiene that is required to for skin health, or for health in general, you lack the appropriate nutrition to keep your immune system up and optimal. Skin breakdown, cellulitis, and all types of skin disorders is very common among the homeless. And it is the start of a decline of a person's health if it's not treated and addressed urgently. And once you have skin breakdown and infections take place, that person, you know, at some point will take up a hospital bed, and that's something completely preventable.
Completely preventable. And we've also, you know, we recognize in more and more pre-diabetic events, conversion into diabetes, which is very difficult to manage when you call outside home. We know that primarily we are trying to save limbs, fingers, toes, right? And we use Civil War type medicine out there, Doc. We use a Burow solution. We use, you know, which is an astringent.
What's a Burow? So I have no idea what that is, what you just said.
So it's an astringent that we use. There's a powder. We take a combine pad or an abdominal pad. We pour the powder on and then sterile saline, get it nice and wet, apply it to the wound so that we can start drawing infections out. It isn't very commonly used, is it, Doc?
No, not at all. But it works.
It works. It works. And then when we can get that, what we're doing is we want to dry that wound out. We want to keep it clean and keep it covered, which requires a regularly changing of the dressings, which can also be a challenge. But the good news is that once a person has gone from extremely inflamed, irritated skin, that amount of instant relief that occurs is quite significant. And that patient will want to go back to that place, right, of relief. And what we say is that, well, if we do these certain things, like one, let's get you connected to a doctor, a real doctor. We want primary care physicians to be directing the healthcare of these patients. We know too often that that has been the emergency room, which has been their only healthcare, and that's usually occurring during trauma, right? Somebody breaks a finger or dislocates a shoulder. They'll go in, and obviously that the ER is not equipped for this. This is not the job of the ER to take care of these types of life events that are long occurring. And go ahead.
I'm going to stop you for 1 second. Alex, one of our viewers this morning, thank you for joining us, Alex, here. He wants to know, do you still need or do you not need antibiotics in this method? Does this remove the need for antibiotics, or is this just a temporary stopgap that you still have to give them antibiotics at some point in time?
So we do topicals, we do single antibiotics, we stay away from triple antibiotics. We want to encourage healthy growth. We don't want to inhibit anything that's going. We like the bacitracin, the zinc. We find that we have a really good result from that. And obviously, once they go into primary care, a lot of times the patients will go into IV so that they can get antibiotics into the system, and then are discharged with an antibiotic that they can take orally.
Are you allowed to administer antibiotics? You're not a doctor, so isn't an antibiotic need a prescription?
Yeah, the over-the-counter bacitracin with zinc, you know, it's what our moms used to put on us when we got a nick or a cut or a scrape. That also is, again, everything that we do is to encourage them to go into a primary care physician.
Do you have a package of what normally is included? Do you have a visual you can show us?
We do it at the headquarters. I'm kind of quarantining at the moment, but we do have a packet that we leave behind, that which includes the gauze pads that we use are specifically dedicated to trying to turn around MRSA and staff. So it's got medicine on it already. We use lots of gauze rolls. Also in there is different sizes of Band-Aids, some of the bacitracin, and we hand those out because we want the patients to be able to do daily wound dressing changes. Sometimes we can go 2 days. We have a team of dedicated nurses that have helped us develop protocols, which we follow what the smart folks say. And those are usually our ICU wound care nurses who are telling us.
The nurses know everything. I think it's the nurses more than the doctors.
Oh, yes.
We've had folks come out into the field with us and saying, before, Doc, we weren't doing a lot of compression on lower extremities. I was kind of being a little bit gentle, but as you know, edema in lower extremities are quite dangerous. so that we have to use a lot of cobane, you know, a lot of elasticate so that we can get to that. And we have to be a little bit more aggressive with the wound once we can reduce enough pain.
Let's go down a rabbit hole for a second here. My late mother and my late aunt, as late in life, both suffered from edema buildup, this weeping fluid. It wasn't really blood. I don't know really what edema is, but it would go and pool in their feet and their legs and their ankles. And somehow, because they weren't moving, they weren't pumping it back up. The body needs movement or effort to take that fluid that gravity pulls down to push it back up into your body somehow here. What is edema buildup? Why does it happen? And what it's horrible when it happens. It's you touch your skin, and my mother would, it was so stretched and bloated, you just take your fingernail and a wound would burst open and the stuff would start coming out, oozing out. Talk about edema a little bit, Doc.
There's a circulation issue where with poor circulation, the blood flow goes down easily due to gravity, especially when you're not moving around too much or when you have poor nutrition and general poor health. The circulation is poor. So everything flows down to your legs simply due to gravity, and your veins do not function well. And when your veins do not function well, it is not pushing that blood back up. And when you have a lack of like adequate protein, adequate nutrition, then what happens is you have poor circulation as a result of that. And so that swelling in the legs essentially is gravity induced. And it causes poor blood flow, poor oxygenation of the legs, and it increases the risk for wounds and infections and stasis dermatitis. We call it that hardening of the skin down in the feet area. It gets hard. It turns brownish. That's all due to poor circulation as a result of being homeless in general.
Are we seeing, the fluid building up outside the cell or inside the cell?
Extracellular, outside the cell, extracellular due to poor circulation.
Well, it's horrible when you see it, and it your legs balloon up. As you said, the skin starts to harden and crack, and I could take my fingernail and run it across my mother's leg towards the end, and it would open up because it was so stretched and so thin and so packed with this stuff. And it just seemed to, and then it was hard, it was heavy. It was like strapping weights under my mother's legs. So we used to try and have people, or we would massage her legs and try and push it back up. Like you're talking about this actual compression, and it's sore and it hurts. You know, you got to be careful as you do this. It was just a never ending loop that we couldn't seem to ever get out of. Is there a way when this happens to fight it? Can you get back the healthy circulation, or is it lost at that point in time?
We've seen recovery. We obviously are encouraging people to elevate, as the document, and I would say to almost everybody that we came across, is to make sure that your legs are elevated above your heart,
right?
Or any area that you may have wounds on that you want to. Now, in the UK, there's a term called rough sleepers, right? There's people trying to figure out, what do you call people who live outside that, one, shows dignity, two, also expresses the environment that they're living in, but to not have any protection to the environment. And also, it's not a deep sleep where people, who might be, on the ground. So it's also difficult for them to maintain elevation of their legs overnight, but it's a start that we can encourage the practice of elevating the legs overnight and as often as possible. But most folks are on the move, right? So trying to get them to not be on the move is also important.
I want to welcome Dan Daly to us this morning here. I don't know if he has any questions. We're talking with Michael Sean Wright about his, what would you call this? A ministry, a mission, a nonprofit? What should we describe this as? Wound walk.
The duty.
The duty. Wow.
We have a human obligation. When our brothers and sisters are down, we're down, right? So the relief that we receive in these moments of being able to tend to people's wounds, that's a pretty encouraging, empowering thing that we all experience when we're out in the field. We've been doing this for over 4 years, bringing out UCI medical students. Sometimes certain programs require you to go out with us into the field before passing your residency.
That's a good thing, yeah. Make them go out and see the world here. So tell me about, let's go back a step here. You saw this happening. How did you start it? Why did you start it? Was it just one, you just went out and helped one, and then that turned into two, and then it turned into more?
Yeah, so you know, I do like the practice of walking. I just like to. And then when we're out and about, you see somebody who is, you know, incapacitated or moving very slow, and you're starting to look at that from a response call based upon anyone who has, you know, basic knowledge of first aid. Anyone who has basic knowledge of first aid can tend, as long as we all practice the same principle of do no harm. And again, the primary goal here is to connect to a clinic with a primary care physician directing the care. And so we also practice what we call patient mediation exchange. The barriers to healthcare are oftentimes, you know, even so medics who are trained to respond on the field, your initial evaluation questions are trying to ascertain whether the patient is cognitive. So those questions start with, doc, do you remember? You know, the first question is, do you know what day it is? Imagine if you live outside. You're not getting that question correct.
No. Doesn't matter what day it is. They all blend into each other here. Yeah.
Right. What city are you in? What's happening in the news? So we had to start very slowly trying to develop a trust exchange between the person there on the ground and us, so that we could, you can imagine if you had something that you weren't proud of, and to exposing that to somebody who you just met, that could be, right? That's a lot. But, you know, I want us to remember that those folks that we see outside, I want you to picture what's happening underneath their shirt, their pant legs, right? There's pain and there's wounds right there. And being able to be at a place of trust that we could both address that in the moment is very important. The longer that they wait, if you were to say, oh, hey, here's an appointment at 4 p.m. at Ultimate or SOS, the likelihood of them getting there is not great. And so we have that moment in which we need to stop and address this.
So let's talk about the moment that you walk up to a homeless person or walk past a homeless person. We have all had that moment. Most of us recoil. Most of us walk around. Most of them try and make it get through as fast because we're afraid of them. Are they afraid of us?
They are. They're afraid of being judged. They know that they're a different, right? They're separated from community. You know, we go to many different cities. Huntington Beach, we have folks that, you know, have been outside for 10 years, for 15 years. They were born in Huntington. They grew up in Huntington. They have family there, but they're separated. They're separated from a community that does love them. And so that moment when we come across somebody outside is first acknowledging the humanity, the shared humanity. We had an encounter the other day. A gentleman was screaming very loud things, racially charged things in a moment where we were all experiencing a lot of pain, you know, given what was happening in the news. And as I was listening to him screaming, this guy is just in pain. Right? He's just in pain. So how can we do harm reduction at that moment? So I went in and I just engaged him safely in a way that
What does that look like? I don't know how to engage a crazy person ranting and raving. I saw one the other day on the street and he's just yelling into the thing. I can't take this and I'm going to do this. And blah, blah, blah. I'm just like, whoa, I'm steering as far away from, like, let's call the cops. Let's get somebody out here. This guy's going to go off.
Right. And so we would never recommend you engage in that moment other than to express maybe to individuals that can, again, reduce the level of trauma that's occurring right at that moment. So what I did in that moment was just try to connect with that person and ask them what they need, right? And so their first response was, I need a beer. And so the second question, or my response was, this way, it's very hot. You know, that's not going to make you feel better. So maybe what flavor of Gatorade do you like the most, right? And so we had that discussion. All of a sudden, he's trying to figure out in his mind, what is something that would bring relief? And once they get to that place in their head, we were able to spend 40 minutes with him addressing a head injury and getting to know some of that person's story. What's important to us is that we don't re-traumatize people while we're out there. And so while he was in an active emotional trauma, a psychological event, that the way that you approach and the way that you engage, first and foremost, starts with the acknowledgement that that's a human being, and that's a human being in pain.
Years ago, I remember watching a policeman who had written a book on what he called verbal judo. And he talked about how going into really heightened trauma situations, usually like domestic violence, and they're slugging each other, they're shooting at each other, they're stabbing each other. And he would walk into the middle of this chaos and this battle, and rather than trying to grab him, yell him, stop, whatever, and just heighten it. They're yelling, he's yelling. He would walk in and he'd say, you got anything to eat?
Exactly.
Can I get a bottle of water? And it would so throw them off. And it was like, well, oh, okay. All right. Yeah. And suddenly it changed the conversation. Kind of like when you do with a kid and they're screaming and crying, you say, oh, look over there. It's a squirrel. You know, it suddenly changes the whole focus of the conversation. Rather than fighting them, let's get them off of that for a minute.
You know, try to also imagine what was like an hour ago before this, you know, this event, or maybe a year ago, or, I mean, that's somebody's brother, that's somebody's son, that could be somebody's father. And again, you know, what we're trying to do is to get an acknowledgement, that could be a look in the eye, that person is human, and I'm human as well.
Right.
That really reduces the harm that's encouraged, because that person feels extremely alone. They've reached that point where, just like the cell will break down the integrity and have fluid leaking, that person, that whole humanity had broken down. So how can we rebuild that? And first and foremost, it's the acknowledgement of their humanity.
I love it. Dan Daly has a question, any contact with their family?
So because of what we do, we want to make sure that we focus in on that wound. We hope that the partners that we work with will be able to surround them with connecting services. So when we think about the continuum of care, we're really good at getting at the wound. We think that organizations like the folks who have contracts like CityNet, who are trained of how to connect to available services. We really love the work of Cal Optima and the individuals like an Ultimate who has a director.
We had Cal Optima on the other day talking about how they go out and at least the serving seniors and some of the work that they do. Yeah,
but it's, you know, the system is under pressure from many different areas, from seniors, Alzheimer's, you know, dementia. That's whole year has really discombobulated all of our sense of normalcy and our sense of connection.
Boy, you can say that again loud and clear. Discombobulated our sense of normalcy. That's going to be the, that's where they're going to write that on the tombstone for 2020 here.
That's right.
Right on that dumpster.
Yeah.
Discombobulated. And that's, but, you know, for individuals who are outside, there was a lot going on during the summer when you were out with us, Doc, that we also saw the communities had a lot of fluctuating numbers, right? We saw folks early on who could be in a motel because they had a job in the food industry. When that went away, that next option was the car. And then when they lost the car, then it was outside. We felt that the system actually did, and we called the system, all the county agencies working together. We felt that there was a tremendous effort and successful effort to preventing more people from pouring out in the street. Now, we have a backlog of, you know, unpaid rent. We have a backlog of a lot of expenses that we all are going to have to look at seriously. Nobody should be outside at this time alone without resources. Nobody. We need to really have a heart-to-heart. And where we start with it is again, from the wound. And then I will, in some cases, we have a young woman that I'm trying to get contact with her family in the Midwest so that they could potentially get her back to the Midwest, getting reconnected to families. If it was, you know, maybe sometimes why they have a breakdown in the family could be abuse. If it's safe for them to go and reconnect with their family, boy, that's the best thing, isn't it? If we can get them back to, you know, mom and dad is worried a lot of times. So if we can reconnect, that would be great.
Paint me a picture of who's out there. I don't know the homeless. I walk around them. We've talked about this before. We'd love to have some homeless come on and describe their journey here if they'd be willing to do that. Tell me who we see.
Oh, you have young folks who may have been living in a sober living home that violated. They got kicked out with no support systems. maybe mom and dad had paid for their, you know, month to month in that situation. When they got, when they exited out, the street was the only place that they would be. They got sicker. They, their addictions really took off, and now they are kind of in a rut of where, you know, they have got to survive. They've got to continue to deal with an ongoing active addiction. Then we have individuals who have chronically been either underemployed or another emotional issues that that create an environment where they were just no longer able to do life. So that day-to-day taking care of things, when that collapses, and, you know, in the very beginning, family and friends will try to prevent homelessness, right? But the frustration, since some people have freedom, right? So freedom to make choices, even if sometimes those choices are harmful, we have got to figure out ways to help a little bit better in that area. Then you have older individuals, males, again, who are dealing with emotional trauma. The first assumption that we make outside is that person is experiencing emotional trauma currently, right? There's psychological trauma currently. It's very painful to be in this environment. And so how they got there are multi-causal. Some of that is, all of that is an emotional issue, a psychological issue of trauma. And we see all races, we see all ages, we see about 7 to 3 male to female that are outside. In the beginning, we started to see families. Thankfully, there was a great effort to make sure that families weren't outside. But what we have now is we have lots of families and individuals in motels that their health is declining. So over the summer, we had partnered with an organization called Volunteers of America. When we would identify a veteran who was outside, we would get a case manager to get them rapid housing, which included a motel, while they were getting a path to permanent housing. But immediate need was that it took a couple of weeks for EBT to reconnect with these individuals. So how do you feed them during a pandemic? So when we got above 100, 120, 126, we had to really reach out and create a community kind of Meals on Wheels program again, just for the nutrition. We're still in a place right now, Doc, that we have lots of individuals who we've moved from outside to inside to a motel situation that you and I have to figure out, how do we do community pop-up wellness clinics outside of some of these motels and set up little temporary MASH tents that, you know, volunteer nurses and doctors, and we can do lots of lavage. We could be washing skin. We could be helping individuals understand that how wounds can turn around faster if we did this. So we have a unseen now issue where people who are in temporary housing, we see need to get community medicine to them.
What a great idea, pop-up clinics. What do you think of that, Doc?
Yeah, very important. Remember last week we spoke with Dr. Jay Lee?
Uh-huh.
He has a mobile clinic.
Yes, he does. Right. Exactly.
He's with Share Ourselves. I don't know if you heard of Share Ourselves, Michael.
We work with them. So we, Michael McGlynn is amazing. You know, that family, wow, what they have done to improve the lives in Orange County. I mean, that is an amazing organization. We send a lot of our folks to their clinic in Santa Ana. I'm sure that the here's another one Michael said to come in, and they're just, that staff is incredible, because, you know, one of the issues that we have, Doc, is if you've noticed, there you know, individuals who call outside home might not have ID, right? We will contact SOS, who will then give us a note to take down to the DMV to get temporary ID so that they can be presented at clinic. They have been doing this forever. We love the mobile units. There had been some, you know, agencies that had attempted to do that over the summer. We felt like you have to be on the ground moving, walking, and developing relationships so that we can create an attraction to that mobile site. Because there's a lot of, you know, obviously conspiracy and fear. You know, what's inside that mobile unit? What's going on there? So they'll resist coming, you know, in seeking help.
I was going to ask you that because that, again, I'm going to show my own bias, but I know a lot of people on these streets have addiction problems. I know a lot of them, veterans, post-traumatic stress and mental illness. of all sorts. I picture a bunch of them as just wild and crazy. You know, they're just, they can't be talked to. They run from you. They attack you. I mean, do you experience this? I've read repeat, they go out and try and count the homeless and they say, we're here to help you. And these people, a certain percentage of them, because they're not all there, I don't know if I'm not saying this the correct way, but they run, they fear, they flee, they fight.
Thank you also for being very willing to say the things that are in your head that a lot of us go, is this politically correct to say this, right?
Right.
The reality is that people in pain tend to act in painful ways, right? So how do we reduce the harm and reduce at that moment that amount of pain that individuals have? Imagine if your skin was on fire all the time. And what that's got, I mean, right? That's very agitating. In the moment that we're able, and Doc, you experience this, when that water comes over their skin, there's a change. There is a relief. There is a moment and a clarity opportunity to say, hey, do you remember my name? I remember yours. Now we start that conversation. It's relationships. It's building that relationship. Nobody wants to be violent. Nobody wants to. We're not born that way. And so we find a lot during maybe an acute emotional episode or psychological episode, we can have a moment where we reconnect. There was a moment probably right before that they were, you know, hanging on by a thread. Then there's a snap. We see less violent crimes on people call outside home than general populations. And so if we were taking a look at who's doing violent crime, right? That's not the people who live outside.
Not the homeless. It's okay. Not.
And, you know, while there are traumatic events that happen eternally, sometimes, you know, we will come across a, you know, two people needing finger splints, right? So the way that we're able to do or to practice harm reduction in those moments is critical. EMTs aren't trained how to do this. Our goal here is with the California Department of Public Health to develop a community medical technician program. We have our volunteers now with Santa Ana College going to get their EMT certification. And then there are going to be an additional 6 months of training in the field with us with psychological trauma counselors of how to go into places where people are actually at. So, you know, we went to LA. You know, it's such a horrible name that we actually have a name. You can picture it in your head because everybody knows this name, Skid Row, where all the tents that are there. We went into those tents and were told that for some folks who had been there for 8 years, not one medical person had gone inside that tent, right, or had come to them. That was really painful, one, because it's very dangerous inside that tent. There's lots of biohazard in that tent. However, that person is 2 miles or even a mile or even 6 blocks from a clinic that would take care of them. Their fear is, what happens to my stuff? I'll lose it all if I go in and, you know, start getting medical treatment. So we as a community have got to figure out how to go treat the wound where it's at.
I seem to have struck a nerve myself here. We've had a flurry of comments here of people giving us suggestions. Sharon says, read The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. The family in this true story never wanted help. How they fight and flee and fear. And Alex and some others have talked about it too. I think that's what we're all afraid of. We're certainly afraid of these people, and we're afraid that they're going to harm us. And to a certain degree, they're certainly seem to be afraid of us for whatever reason. They're in pain. They're going through psychotic episodes. They're in drug withdrawal. They're some other issue, and it's not easy to bridge that gap. It seems you seem to have done it easier.
But what's amazing is each one of us want to do something, right? So what we do is we provide families with the opportunity during the pandemic. You know, the family can help us by making 60 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Some families and some individuals can help us assemble our wound care kits. We have lots of folks that do volunteer opportunities because it's really big when you see it from this far, right? We're in the best position because as we are this close, we're able to see this aspect of it. And then as we start looking at where the systems need to apply for systemic change, those get more and more complicated. it's very easy for us in this moment to figure out how to get water tanks to people and to clean that wound in that moment and have a half hour with an individual of which we are now starting to develop a relationship to reduce self-harm and to reduce the boundaries or the fear of what medicine could mean for them at that moment.
Yeah.
And that means health, that means mental health.
Fear of medicine, right.
Fear of medicine.
It seems like the entry point to your connect the first person who's homeless is a physical wound that allows you to come and serve them. But as you are serving and taking care of that wound, it also opens up an opportunity to allow you to address or at least reconnect with their humanity, to let them know that they have intrinsic value for just being who they are, as opposed to, you know, their status in life, their position, their job, their socioeconomic situation, but to really just to let them know that they're loved, perhaps.
Well, they have gotten to that point where if tonight was the last night, that's where it ended, right? What we have to do is turn on that light inside of them to picture what tomorrow could be. In this moment, they've experienced a positive outcome from being willing to, at that moment, put their health care first. Think about that. You know, that to get to the point to get beyond the paralyzing depression that people are at and the resignation that this wound isn't going to get better, right? And you know exactly how you feel, too. If you've got any type of infection or, you know, you're sick and you're not feeling like going and doing your best work at this moment, to have that happen every single day of your life to a point where you go, it's not going to get better. How do we turn around that psychological DNR?
Somebody once said to me, in order to survive every day, you need to wake up with a sense of hope and a sense of tomorrow. And for many of these people, I bet there is no hope. It's hopelessness. And they've accepted it or believe that it's never going to change. And I suspect they don't think of tomorrow. They're just trying to make it through today.
You know, that's the first time I said that. And I think a lot about the kindness of which doctors and nurses have got to approach this, the human compassion, but this idea of turning around that psychological DNR, right? Do not resuscitate.
Yeah,
right. They have gotten to a place where they don't have that hope of tomorrow, like you're saying.
Right.
That I think that's what we're doing in the moment. It needs to have follow-up. You know, doctors, yes, you know, follow-ups are the best. We're your official, we are your initial touch of the wound. Then the follow-up from the system that happens after that will have longer-term impact. But we're in a triage situation currently in Orange County, in these cities where individuals, you know, have gotten to the point where we have got to stabilize those wounds so that we can have a moment of figuring out what's next. The good news is cities have more shelter spaces coming. The bad news is the California Department of Public Health, critical recommendation number one, is to reduce the amount of congregate shelter environments during a pandemic.
Yeah, right.
So shelters here in Orange County are experiencing increased outbreaks of COVID. You would never recommend a patient doc to go into a room during a pandemic where viral loads build and build and build. So our hope here is that Project Tool Belt and the ability to acquire motels, we believe is critical. However, hotels where people are just housed or warehoused without medical is a failure.
All right. So we got 10 minutes left roughly here. We got two questions we got to get to. One is my question and one is several people's question, Dan's question. We'll start with the bigger one. You're out there in the front lines. Give us some steps, some cures, some ideas, some dreams of how we can prevent this or we can help it or reduce it or diminish it? Or are we just holding the sea back? We're just fighting a never-ending losing battle.
We see more wounds than we have ever seen in Orange County, but we've also seen the hope and the light that's coming by a system that takes a long time to build, but we're there. The Be Well Mental Health is, the doors are opening. That is a first in the county effort to deal with rapid stabilization of folks who are dealing with addictions so that we can get a mental health bed, which we have never had. There is no way to, there, first of all, there's no opiate detox doc in Orange County. How's that?
There's no opiate detox. If I'm on opiates, I can't go someplace to get off them.
If you are experiencing alcohol, you know, withdrawal systems, there is that.
Yeah, sober homes and stuff, yeah.
Sober homes, sobering facilities. There is not that. So we had a patient that we were dealing with a very severe infection. He was a long-term opiate user and had for years and years and years never considered how he could get to a place where get past that physical pain of withdrawal. And so thankfully, we were able to address it where for 72 hours, they were getting medical treatment for the infection that also allowed us to detox by default. So Doc, what's happening in the brain when somebody has addictions to opiates?
Yeah, well, it's all you think about. And you're thinking about how to get the next dose of opiate, whether you're going to get it legally or illegally. Otherwise, you get withdrawal symptoms and you don't want
it. It's all consuming.
The brain is screaming, right? So all of those connections, you know, are just screaming for that, you know, that to go away. The vast majority of individuals are not addicted to opiates in that extreme severe, but there may be other things that are going on that are what we call self-harm. Self-harm is neglect of hygiene, neglect of personal care. And then, you know, there could be lots of different things that are also going on. We believe all of this is mental health. All of this. This is current psychological trauma. So we don't even have a chance to get to PTSD. Right? That P, that first P is present, present time. So how do we address that? That's where community comes in. And that's where we've had our biggest success is the ability to get the right supplies at the right time to the right place. We have to do strike teams, if you will, and approach this much differently. We go to places that EMS cannot physically go. So we have to figure out ways to bring that person who's over here to a place where EMS crew can actually transport. But again, during this time of COVID, we have a 0% availability of beds of ICU. ERs are very under challenge. And Doc, you've probably seen it around that urgent cares have become the place where the waits can be 6 hours, 7 hours. And we think about this in a moment. How can we relieve the pressures from an already challenged system? That's why the community pop-up centers, we are doing one. We will be online early next week. We hope to have two more additional ones next week.
So last question, how, we're on a business channel here, so I got asked about the business of this. How in the world do you pay for all this, for your time, your services, your needs, your supplies and everything else? And how can people help you?
So it quickly became apparent that this isn't something that we that there's an exit strategy on, right? we have a foreseeable need. So I am the executive director of a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy institute called the Contemporary Policy Institute. My salary was donated so that we could scale this NGO or non-governmental organization during the pandemic. And so we hope that eventually we can be surrounded with enough systems where that time involvement goes down as the responsibility is spread more often. Everything we put on a person's arm or leg is donated by the community. Mm-hmm. We have an Amazon wish list at woundwalk.org.
Okay.
And that list changes all the time based upon what we see and what we need.
And how would they take advantage of that? Where would they go? Would they just send you money? Would they buy something and send it to you? They drop it off? Where do they go?
So on our Amazon wish list at woundwalk.org, they hit the item that they would want to support. Maybe it's a box of gauze bandages. Those are $7. So a family could do that. And then it gets shipped to us. And then we take it right to the field.
I see. I buy it and ship it to you. Right.
Right. So Amazon, you know, has been pretty frictionless opportunities. And again, our ability to change based upon what we see. Sometimes we need more ice packs. Right now, our current need is better face shields.
Yeah.
Because as we go into these environments where we're going to have to do longer period of wound treatment, we have to increase that level of PPE. We are also working on tying in on a technology way, the ability to do an assessment quickly. Sometimes we primarily work at night because people are more comfortable spending longer periods of time getting wound treatment for, but we need devices that connect to each other. So the ability to read an O2 level, a heart rate, a blood pressure, and in some cases, even an EKG. Look where we've come, Doc.
Wow.
In our pockets, right? We have so I can see if a person is experiencing tachycardia, right? And so we
just
see
from that little thing right there, how does that work? You just hold it and it tells me if I'm having a heart attack?
So this does not detect whether you're having a heart attack, but what can tell us is whether or not you have a normal sinus rhythm. So the patient will put two fingers here. I've got an app on my phone, mm-hmm. and then we can do a reading. Now, here's the amazing part about this. Doc, I spend the $25 to send that off to a cardiologist who reads it, right? So that by the time we get them into the clinic, we have got a record of what was happening at that moment in the field. And so that they have some history of what was going on so that they can better direct. The more information we have with a person, the better. And so, you know, technology is a place where we have to rethink this. What does a medic look like?
Yeah.
We believe that community medical technicians not only are necessary, but they're effective. And, you know, Doc, if you were to just, what do you think an amputation of an arm costs?
Oh.
Taxpayers.
It'll cost you an arm and a leg.
Arm and a leg. Oh, there we go. Oh, boom. Seriously, so, folks.
So that one amputation would pay for two community medical technicians to be out into the field. Again, we're talking about folks that are trained of how to do trauma reduction, harm reduction, and then connect to within the clinic. And then at that point, the systems that the county are putting in place, there's no lack of desire to fix this, right? There's no, every one of us agree, all of us. Wounds need to heal.
Homelessness needs to go down. And, you know, I'll wrap this up with my one little observation here. I sit at the intersection of Orange County business here. We have conversations every week when I sit in this chair. And the one thing that amazes me is in such a politically charged time where we can't agree on anything, or I say black and somebody immediately says white or whatever. I am amazed at how much unity there is left and right and center to solve this problem. It's a painful problem to watch. It's an expensive problem to deal with. We're sending cops and services and to try and just handle emergencies and problems and medical emergencies. It fills up hospital beds. They fill up jail cells. They fill up time and effort and everything here. It drives business away because people are urinating all over the front of the business or scaring customers away or whatever. I mean, you can come up with 100 really tangible reasons beyond the heartfelt reasons that you feel. And I'm amazed at the consensus there is to solve this. I'm a bit saddened that it's so difficult to do. Because the consensus and the will, I think, in the community is there. There is no political pushback. Nobody's saying, no, forget it. I don't want to help this problem.
And you know, for us, you know, and this may be, here's where we're at. We need to get to the wound today.
Yeah.
And that's, the rest will reveal itself. And we need to be flexible on the ideas of how do we increase public safety.
Yeah.
Right. So public safety and
public health, public safety and the human, it's socially, morally, economically, all makes sense. Right.
But we've been incredibly moved by the neighborhoods that we go to. These are neighbors also seeing seeing this pain up close and personal,
right.
but yet saying to us, what do you need? How can we help you? Right. And, you know, we believe that if we can start turning these, we've had 6,000 patient contacts, Doc, since the beginning of the pandemic.
Wow.
And all of that's possible because community said, yeah, all right. You know, at the beginning, people were saying, I told you this. You know, hey, you're just putting a Band-Aid on it. Yes, exactly. It says it right on the package.
Right, Band-Aid. We're putting a Band-Aid. It says it. Well, that's what it starts. Thank you, Dr. Trinh, for bringing this to light here. Any final thoughts? Take us out.
Wow. Michael, how do we help? Do we go to your website? And is there a way to donate online financially as well on that website?
Sure. So our urgent needs on the Amazon wish list can be found at woundwalk.org.
Okay.
That is woundwalk.org.
There you go.
Got it.
And then our fiscal sponsor is the Orange County Poverty Alleviation Coalition, which you can contribute, tax deductible. We are trying to raise money for our scholarship for our three initial medics to go to EMT. That costs us $1,300 per person. We have identified and people who come, young people from neighborhoods that are challenged. Right, has said, okay, I've grown up with this. How do I become part of that? So native language speaking.
Somebody wants you to repeat that charity where they can financially support the.
So on Facebook, search for Orange County Poverty Alleviation Coalition.
Poverty Alleviation Coalition. All right.
And those are our fiscal sponsors, which we can take tax-deductible donations. And in this moment,
Doc's going to find it right and put now. It up there. There it is, Orange County Poverty there. Alleviation Coalition. There you go.
OPAC, yep. And then, again, on our wish list changes quite oftenly. We've been really encouraged. And we change based upon the supplies that we have. So the supply, if we have that supply and that tool, we're able then to go out to the field with it.
I wish we could go on and on. We're over the time already. We got other shows. We got to run here. I know you could go on for a while here because you got a lot of great insights and you're doing God's work here. I just want to applaud you on behalf of everybody. And hope that we all reach out and support you.
Yes.
Just because it'll be a good work for us, and it'll be one Band-Aid on the problem that maybe will start to cure the problem. Heal the wound.
Yes, heal the wound.
Heal the wound.
Heal the wound.
Wounds don't wait. We don't either.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Yeah. Thanks, guys, so much here. I hope you'll come back and give us some more updates as you go along with your work here.
Well, thank you. And to you, Doc, thank you for everything you've done.
Thank you, thank you Michael. Right. Michael, maybe next time Michael can take us physically with him when he's on the
wound. That would be wonderful. I'd love to have him carry a camera, and if we could do that, he could connect to his smartphone, and we could probably stream him live as he's out there. That would be
we'll stream you live, Michael.
We could virtually walk with you here. We can walk a mile in your shoes.
Come on, let's go. Let's do it.
Once again, we hear why this is such a powerful way to tune in and find out more about the health of our community and the health of our lives and ourselves as we talk about all things health and healing the world around us. Right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.